This is disc number 5.
This endeavor is not without risk, Carter told Sarah. But it is critical to the security of the United States, and it has the agency's full support. If you're interested, remain where you are. If not, walk out the door and we'll pretend you stumbled in here by mistake. Sarah would never be sure how Carter had summoned him or from where he came. He was small and spare, with short cropped hair and great temples. His eyes were the greenest Sarah had ever seen. His handshake, like Carter's, was fleeting but probing as a doctor's touch. His English was fluent but heavily accented. If he had a name, it wasn't yet relevant. They settled at the long table in the formal dining room, Carter and his nameless collaborator on one side and Sarah on the other, like a suspect in an interrogation room. The collaborator was now in possession of her CIA file. He was leafing slowly through the pages as if seeing them for the first time, which she doubted was the case. His first question was put to her as a mild accusation.
You wrote your doctoral dissertation at Harvard on the German Expressionists.
It seemed a peculiar place to begin. She was tempted to ask why he was interested in the topic of her dissertation, but instead she simply nodded her head and said, "Yes, that's correct."
In your research, did you ever come across a man named Viktor Frankl?
He was a disciple of Max Beckmann, she said. Frankl is little known today, but at the time he was considered extremely influential and was highly regarded by his contemporaries. In 1936, the Nazis declared his work degenerate, and he was forbidden to continue painting. Unfortunately, he decided to remain in Germany. By the time he decided to leave, it was too late. He was deported to Auschwitz in 1942, along with his wife and teenage daughter Irene. Only Irene survived. She went to Israel after the war and was one of the country's most influential artists in the 50s and 60s. I believe she died several years ago.
That's correct, said Carter's collaborator, his eyes still on Sarah's file.
Why are you interested in whether I knew about Viktor Frankl?
Because he was my grandfather.
You're Irene's son?
Yes, he said. Irene was my mother.
She looked at Carter, who was gazing at his own hands.
I guess I know who's running this endeavor of yours.
She looked back at the man with gray temples and green eyes.
You're Israeli. Guilty as charged. Shall we continue, Sarah, or would you like me to leave now?
She hesitated a moment, then nodded. Do I get a name, or are names forbidden? He gave her one. It was vaguely familiar. And then she remembered where she had seen it before. The Israeli agent who was involved in the bombing of the Gare de Lyon in Paris. You're the one who...
Yes, he said. I'm the one.
He looked down at the open file again and turned to a new page.
But let's get back to you, shall we? We have a lot of ground to cover in very little time.
He started slowly, a climber plodding his way through the foothills, conserving his strength for the unseen perils that lay ahead. His questions were short and efficient and methodically posed, as though he were reading them from a prepared list, which he wasn't. He devoted the first hour to her family. Her father, the high-flying Citicorp executive who'd had no time for his children, but plenty of time for other women. Her mother, whose life had crumbled after the divorce and was now living like a hermit in her classic 8 Manhattan apartment on Fifth Avenue. Her older sister, who Sarah described as the one who got all the brains and beauty. Her little brother, who had checked out of life early and, much to her father's disappointment, was now working for pennies in a ski rental shop somewhere in Colorado. After family came another hour devoted solely to her expensive European schooling. The American in St. John's Wood, where she'd done her elementary years, the international middle school in Paris, where she'd learned how to speak French and get into trouble, the all-girls boarding school outside Geneva, where she'd been incarcerated by her father for the purpose of sorting herself out. It was in Switzerland, she volunteered, where she discovered her passion for art. Each of her answers was greeted by the scratching of his pen. He wrote in red ink on a legal pad the color of sunflowers. At first, she thought he was scribbling in shorthand or some form of hieroglyphics. Then she realized he was making notes in Hebrew. The fact that it was written right to left, and that he could write with equal speed with either hand,
served to reinforce her impression that she had passed through the looking glass. At times he seemed to have all the time in the world. At others he would glare at his wristwatch and frown, as though calculating how much farther they could push on before making camp for the night. From time to time he slipped into other languages. His French was quite good, his Italian faultless, but tinged with a vague accent that betrayed the fact he was not a native speaker. When he addressed her in German, a change came over him, a straightening of his back, a hardening of his severe features. She answered him in the language of his question, though invariably her words were recorded in Hebrew on his yellow legal pad. For the most part, he did not challenge her, though any inconsistencies, real or imagined, were pursued with a prosecutorial zeal. "This passion for art," he said. "Where do you think it came from? Why art? Why not literature or music? Why not film or drama?" "Paintings became a refuge for me, a sanctuary."
"From what?"
"Real life."
"You were a rich girl, going to the finest schools in Europe. What was wrong with your life?"
He switched from English into German in mid-accusation.
"What were you running from?"
"You judge me?" she responded in the same language.
"Of course."
"May we speak in English?"
"If you must."
Paintings are other places, other lives. An instant in time that exists on the canvas and nowhere else.
"You like to inhabit these places?"
It was an observation, not a question. She nodded in response.
"You like to lead other lives, become other people. You like to walk through Vincent's wheat fields and Monet's flower gardens.
And even through Frankl's nightmares." He laid down his pen for the first time.
"Is that why you applied to join the agency? Because you wanted to lead another life? Because you wanted to become another person?"
"No, I did it because I wanted to serve my country." He gave her a disapproving frown, as if he found her response naive, and then shot another glance at his wristwatch. Time was his enemy.
"Did you meet Arabs when you were growing up in Europe?"
"Of course."
"Boys? Girls?"
"Both."
"What sort of Arabs?"
"Arabs who walk on two legs, Arabs from Arab countries."
"You're more sophisticated than that, Sarah."
"Lebanese, Palestinians, Jordanians, Egyptians."
"What about Saudis? Did you ever go to school with Saudis?"
"There were a couple of Saudi girls at my school in Switzerland."
"They were rich, these Saudi girls?"
"We were all rich."
"Were you friends with them?"
"They were hard to get to know. They were standoffish. They kept to themselves."
"And what about Arab boys?"
"What about them?"
"Were you ever friends with any of them?"
"I suppose."
"Ever date any of them? Ever sleep with any of them?"
"No."
"Why not?"
"I guess my taste didn't run to Arab men."
"You had French boyfriends?"
"A couple."
"British?"
"Sure."
"But no Arabs?"
"No Arabs."
"Are you prejudiced against Arabs?"
"Don't be ridiculous."
"So it's conceivable you could have dated an Arab, you just didn't?"
"I hope you're not going to ask me to serve as bait in a honey trap, because—"
"Don't be ridiculous."
"Then why are you asking me these questions?"
"Because I want to know whether you'd be comfortable in a social and professional setting with Arab men."
"The answer is yes."
"You don't automatically see a terrorist when you see an Arab man?"
"No."
"Are you sure about that, Sarah?"
"I suppose it depends on the sort of Arab you have in mind."
He looked at his watch. "It's getting late," he said to no one in particular. "I'm sure poor Sarah is famished."
He drew a heavy red line across his page of hieroglyphics.
"Let's order some food, shall we? Sarah will feel better after she has something to eat."
They ordered kebabs from a carryout in the heart of Georgetown. The food came 20 minutes later, delivered by the same black Suburban that had brought Sarah to the townhouse 3 hours earlier. Gabriel treated its arrival as a signal to begin the night session. For the next 90 minutes, he focused on her education and her knowledge of art history. His questions came at such a rapid-fire pace, she scarcely had time for her food. As for his own, it sat untouched next to his yellow legal pad. "He's an ascetic," she thought. "He can't be bothered with food. He lives in a bare room and subsists on coarse bread and a few drops of water a day." Shortly after midnight, he carried his plate into the kitchen and deposited it on the counter. When he returned to the dining room, he stood for a moment behind his chair, with one hand pressed to his chin and his head tilted slightly to one side. The light from the chandelier had turned his eyes to Emerald, and they were flashing restlessly over her like searchlights. "He can see the summit," she thought. "He's preparing himself for the final assault."
"I see from your file that you're unmarried."
"Correct."
"Are you involved with anyone at the moment?"
"No."
"Sleeping with anyone?"
She looked at Carter, who gazed sadly back at her as if to say, "I told you things might get personal."
"No, I'm not sleeping with anyone."
"Why not?"
"Have you ever lost someone close to you?"
The dark look that came suddenly over his face, combined with Carter's restless shifting in his chair, alerted her that she had strayed into some forbidden zone.
"I'm sorry," she said. "I didn't..."
"It's Ben, I take it. Ben is the reason you're not involved with anyone?"
"Yes, it's Ben. Of course it's Ben."
"Tell me about him." She shook her head.
"No," she said softly. "You don't get to know about Ben. Ben is mine. Ben isn't part of the deal."
"How long did you date?"
"I told you..."
"How long did you see him, Sarah? It's important or I wouldn't be asking."
"About 9 months."
"And then it ended?"
"Yes, it ended."
"You ended it, didn't you?"
"Yes."
"Ben was in love with you. Ben wanted to marry you."
"Yes."
"But you didn't feel the same way. You weren't interested in marriage. Maybe you weren't interested in Ben."
"I cared about him very much.
But?"
"But I wasn't in love with him."
"Tell me about his death."
"You can't be serious."
"I'm quite serious."
"I don't talk about his death. I never talk about Ben's death. Besides, you know how Ben died. He died at 9:03 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time, live on television. Everyone in the world watched Ben die."
"Did you?" "Some of the passengers from Flight 175 managed to make phone calls."
"That's correct."
"Was Ben one of them?"
"Yes."
"Did he call his father?"
"No."
"Did he call his mother?"
"No."
"His brother, his sister?"
"No."
"Who did he call, Sarah?"
Her eyes welled with tears.
"He called me, you son of a bitch."
"What did he say to you?"
"He told me the plane had been hijacked. He told me they'd killed the flight attendants. He told me the plane was making wild movements. He told me he loved me and that he was sorry. He was about to die and he told me he was sorry. And then we lost the connection."
"What did you do?"
"I turned on the television and saw the smoke pouring from the North Tower of the World Trade Center. It was a few minutes after Flight 11 struck. No one was really sure then what had happened. I called the FAA and told them about Ben's call. I called the FBI. I called the Boston police. I felt so utterly fucking helpless."
"And then?"
"I watched television. I waited for the phone to ring again. It never did. At 9:03 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time, the second plane hit the World Trade Center. The South Tower was burning. Ben was burning." A single tear spilled onto her cheek. She punched it away and glared at him. "Are you satisfied?" He was silent. "Now it's my turn to ask a question, and you'd better answer it truthfully, or I'm leaving."
"Ask me anything you like, Sarah."
"What do you want from me?"
"We want you to quit your job at the Phillips Collection and go to work for Jihad Incorporated. Are you still interested?"
It was left to Carter to place the contract in front of her. Carter with his Puritan righteousness and corduroy blazer. Carter with his therapeutic demeanor and American-accented English. Gabriel slipped out like a night thief and crossed the street to Carter's battered Volvo. He knew what Sarah's answer would be. She had given it to him already. The South Tower was burning, she had said. Ben was burning.
and so Gabriel was not concerned by the gallows expression on her face 20 minutes later when she emerged stoically from the townhouse and descended the steps to the waiting Suburban. Nor was he disturbed by the sight of Carter 5 minutes after that, ambling morosely across the street like a pallbearer making for the casket. He climbed behind the wheel and started the engine.
"We have a plane at Andrews waiting to take you back to Israel," he said. "We need to make one stop along the way. There's someone who'd like a word with you before you leave."
It was after midnight. K Street had been abandoned to the overnight delivery trucks and the taxicabs. Carter was driving at a faster pace than usual and making repeated glances at his wristwatch.
"She doesn't come for free, you know. There'll be costs to using her. She'll have to be resettled when this is over and protected for a long time." "But you'll handle that, won't you, Adrian? You're the one with all the money. The budget for the American intelligence community alone is far more than the budget of our entire country."
"Have you forgotten that this operation does not exist? Besides, you're going to walk away with a great deal of ZZ's money."
"Fine," said Gabriel. "You can be the one to tell Sarah Bancroft that she's going to spend the next 10 years living on a kibbutz in the Galilee, hiding from the forces of global jihad."
"All right. We'll pay for her resettlement." Carter made a series of turns. For a moment, Gabriel lost track of what street they were on. They passed the facade of a large neoclassical building, then turned into an official-looking driveway. On the left was a fortified guardhouse with bulletproof glass. Carter lowered his window and handed over his badge to the guard.
"We're expected."
The guard consulted a clipboard, then handed back Carter's ID.
"Pull through, then stop in front of the barricade on the left. The dogs will give the car the once-over, then you can head on in."
Carter nodded and raised his window. Gabriel said,
"Where are we?"
Carter wound his way through the barricades and stopped where he'd been told.
"The back door of the White House," he said.
"Who are we seeing?" Gabriel asked. But Carter was now speaking to another officer, this one struggling to control a large German shepherd straining at a thick leather leash. Gabriel, whose fear of dogs was legendary within the office, sat motionless while the animal prowled the perimeter of the Volvo, searching for concealed explosives. A moment later, they were directed through another security gate. Carter pulled into an empty parking space on East Executive Drive and shut down the engine.
"This is as far as I go."
"Who am I seeing, Adrian?"
"Go through that gate over there and walk up the drive toward the house. You'll be out in a minute."
The dogs came first. Two coal black terriers that shot from the diplomatic entrance like bullets from a gun barrel and launched a preemptive strike on Gabriel's trousers. The president emerged a few seconds later. He advanced on Gabriel with one hand out while the other was gesturing for the terriers to break off their onslaught. The two men shook hands briefly, then set off along the footpath that ran around the periphery of the south lawn. The terriers launched one more sortie against Gabriel's ankles. Carter watched as Gabriel turned and murmured something in Hebrew that sent the dogs scurrying toward the protection of a Secret Service agent. Their conversation lasted just 5 minutes, and to Carter it seemed the president did most of the talking. They moved at a brisk pace, stopping only once in order to settle what appeared to be a minor disagreement. Gabriel removed his hands from his coat pockets and used them to illustrate whatever point he was trying to make. The president appeared unconvinced at first. Then he nodded and clapped Gabriel hard on the shoulders. They completed their circuit and parted at the diplomatic entrance. As Gabriel started back toward East Executive Drive, the dogs trotted after him, then turned and darted into the White House after their master. Gabriel slipped through the open gate and climbed into Carter's car.
"How was he?" Carter asked as they turned into 15th Street.
"Resolute."
"Looked like you had a bit of an argument."
"I'd characterize it as a polite disagreement."
"About what?"
"Our conversation was private, Adrian, and it will remain so."
"Good man," said Carter.
Chapter 18. London. The announcement that Isherwood Fine Arts had sold Daniel in the Lion's Den by Sir Peter Paul Rubens for the sum of £10 million came on the first Wednesday of the new year.
By Friday, the clamor had been eclipsed by a rumor that Isherwood was bringing aboard a partner. It was Oliver Dimbleby, Isherwood's tubby nemesis from King Street, who heard it first, though later even Dimbleby would be hard-pressed to pin down its precise origin. To the best of his recollection, the seeds were planted by Penelope, the luscious hostess from the little wine bar in Jermyn Street where Isherwood could often be seen whiling away slow afternoons.
"She's blonde," Penelope had said. "Natural blonde, Oliver, not like your girls. Pretty. American with a bit of an English accent."
At first Penelope suspected Isherwood was once again making a fool of himself with a younger woman, but she soon realized that she was witnessing a job interview.
"And not just any job, Oliver. Sounded like something big."
Dimbleby would have thought nothing of it had he not received a report of a second sighting, this one from Percy, a notorious gossip who waited tables in the breakfast room at the Dorchester Hotel.
"It definitely weren't lovers,"
he told Dimbleby with the assurance of a man who knew his material.
"It was all salary and benefits. There was a fair amount of haggling. She was playing hard to get."
Dimbleby slipped Percy 10 quid and asked whether he'd caught the woman's name.
"Bancroft," said Percy. "Sarah Bancroft, stayed 2 nights. Bill paid in its entirety by Isherwood Fine Arts, Mason's Yard, St. James's."
A third sighting, a cozy dinner at Mirabelle, confirmed to Dimbleby that something was definitely afoot. The next evening he bumped into Jeremy Crabb, director of the Bonham's Old Masters Department, at the bar in Green's Restaurant. Crabb was drinking a very large whiskey and still licking his wounds over Isherwood's monumental coup.
"I had that Rubens, Oliver, but Julie outfoxed me. He's 10 million richer, and I'm facing a firing squad at dawn. Now he's expanding operations, getting himself a flashy new frontman, from what I hear. But don't quote me, Oliver. It's nothing but malicious talk."
When Dimbleby asked whether Isherwood's flashy frontman might in fact be an American woman named Sarah Bancroft, Crabb gave him a sideways smile.
"Anything's possible, love. Remember, we are talking about Juicy Julie Isherwood."
For the next 48 hours, Oliver Dimbleby devoted his copious spare time to researching the provenance of one Sarah Bancroft. A drinking companion on the faculty of the Courteau described her as a meteor. The same companion learned from an acquaintance at Harvard that her dissertation was considered required reading for anyone serious about the German Expressionists. Dimbleby then dialed up an old chum who cleaned paintings at the National Gallery of Art in Washington, and asked him to poke around the Phillips for clues about her departure. It was a squabble over money, reported the chum. 2 days later, he called Dimbleby back and said it had something to do with an office love affair gone bad. A third call brought the news that Sarah Bancroft had parted company with the Phillips collection on good terms, and that the motive for her departure was nothing more than a desire to spread her wings. As for her personal life, meaning her marital status, she was described as single and unavailable. Which left but one unanswered question. Why was Isherwood suddenly taking on a partner? Jeremy Crabb heard he was ill. Roddy Hutchinson heard he had a tumor in his abdomen the size of a honeydew melon. Penelope, the girl from Isherwood's wine bar, heard he was in love with a wealthy Greek divorcee and was planning to spend his remaining days in blessed fornication on a beach in Mykonos. Dimbleby, though he found the lavish rumors entertaining, suspected that the truth was far more prosaic. Julian was getting on. Julian was tired. Julian had just pulled off a coup. Why not bring someone on board to help lighten the load? His suspicions were confirmed 3 days later when a small item appeared at the bottom of the Times Arts page, announcing that Sarah Bancroft, formerly of the Phillips Collection in Washington, D.C., would be joining Isherwood Fine Arts as its first associate director.
"I've been at this for 40 years, Isherwood told the Times. "I needed someone to help shoulder the burden, and the angels sent me Sarah."
She arrived the following week, on the Monday. By coincidence, Oliver Dimbleby was waddling along Duke Street at the precise moment she turned through the passageway into Mason's Yard, wearing a Burberry trench coat, her blonde hair swept back so that it hung between her shoulder blades like a satin cape. Dimbleby did not realize then who she was,
but Oliver being Oliver, he poked his head through the passageway for a look-see at her backside. To his surprise, she was making a beeline toward Isherwood's gallery in the far corner of the quadrangle. She rang the bell that first day and had to wait 2 very long minutes for Tanya, Isherwood's lethargic secretary, to buzz her up. It was Tanya's initiation of the new girl, thought Dimbleby. Tanya, he suspected, would be gone by Friday. Her impact was instantaneous. Sarah was a whirlwind. Sarah was a much-needed breath of fresh air. Sarah was all things Isherwood was not, prompt, regimented, disciplined, and, of course, very American. She started arriving at the gallery at 8 each morning. Isherwood, who was used to strolling into work at the Italian at hour of 10, was forced to trim his sails accordingly. She put his disgraceful books in order and spruced up the large common office they shared. She replaced the missing letters on the intercom and the soiled brown carpeting on the stairs. She began the painful process of liquidating Isherwood's vast pile of dead stock and entered into quiet negotiations to take over the adjacent office space currently occupied by Miss Archer's dreary little travel agency.
"She's an American," said Dimbleby. "She's expansionist by nature. She'll conquer your country and afterwards tell you it's for your own good."
Tanya, as it turned out, did not survive till Friday, and was last seen leaving the gallery on the Wednesday evening. Her departure was handled by Sarah, and was therefore accomplished with a smoothness not usually seen at Isherwood Fine Arts. The generous severance package,
"Very generous from what I hear," said Dimbleby,
permitted her to take a long, well-deserved winter holiday in Morocco. By the next Monday, there was a new girl on duty in Isherwood's anteroom, a tall, olive-skinned Italian woman with riotous dark hair and eyes the color of caramel, named Elena Farnese. An informal straw poll, conducted by Roddy Hutchinson, found that among the men of St. James's, she was regarded as even more beautiful than the fetching Sarah. The name Isherwood Fine Arts suddenly took on a new meaning among the denizens of Duke Street, and the gallery was hit by a rash of drop-bys and pop-ins. Even Jeremy Crabb from Bonham's started dropping by unannounced just to have a glimpse at Isherwood's collection. After shoring up the gallery, Sarah began venturing out to meet her compatriots. She did formal meetings with the leading lights at the various London auction houses. She lunched expensively with the collectors and had quiet drinks in the late afternoon with their advisors, their consultants, and their assorted hangers-on. She popped into the galleries of Isherwood's competitors and said hello. She stopped at the bar at Green's once or twice and bought a round for the boys. Oliver Dimbleby finally screwed up the courage to invite her to lunch, but wisely she made it a coffee instead. Next afternoon they had a latte in a paper cup at an American chain on Piccadilly. Oliver fondled her hand and invited her to dinner.
"I'm afraid I don't do dinner," she said. "Why ever not?"
wondered Oliver as he waddled back to his gallery in King Street.
"Why ever not indeed?"
Uzi Navot had had his eye on it for some time. It was a perfect port in a storm, he'd always thought. The sort of place to stick in your back pocket for the inevitable rainy day. It was located just 10 miles beyond the M25 Ring Road in Surrey, or, as he explained to Gabriel, an hour by tube and car from Isherwood's Gallery in St. James's. The house was a rambling Tudor pile with high gables and tiny leaded windows, reached by a long, rutted beach drive and shielded by a forbidding brick and iron gate. There was a tumble-down barn and a pair of shattered greenhouses. There was a tangled garden for thinking deep thoughts, 8 private acres for wrestling with one's demons, and a stock pond that hadn't been fished for 15 years. The rental agent, when handing Navot the keys, had referred to it as Winslow Haven. To a field hand like Navot, it was Nirvana. Dina, Ramona, and Yakov worked in the dusty library. Lavon and Yossi set up shop in a rambling rumpus room hung with the heads of many dead animals. As for Gabriel, he made a shakedown studio for himself in a light-filled second-floor drawing room overlooking the garden. Because he could not show his face round the art world of London, he dispatched others to procure his supplies. Their missions were special operations unto themselves. Dina and Yossi made separate trips to L. Cornelison and Sons in Russell Street, carefully dividing the order between them so that the girls who worked there would not realize they were filling the order of a professional restorer.
Yakov went to a lighting shop in Earl's Court to purchase Gabriel's halogen lamps, and then to a master carpenter in Camden Town to collect a custom easel. Elie Lavon saw to the frame. A newly minted expert in all things al-Bakri, he took issue with Gabriel's decision to go antique Italian.
Zizi's taste is old French, he said. The Italian will clash with Zizi's sense of style.
But Gabriel always found that the more muscular carving of the Italian frames best suited Vincent's impasto style, and so it was an Italian frame that Lavon ordered from the enchanted Bury Street premises of Arnold Wiggins and Sons. Sarah came to them early each evening, always by a different route, and always with Lavon handling the counter-surveillance. She was a quick study, and, as Gabriel had anticipated, was blessed with a flawless memory. Still, he was careful not to smother her beneath an avalanche of information. They started usually by 7, broke at 9 for a family dinner in the formal dining room, then carried on until nearly midnight, when she was shuttled back to her apartment in Chelsea by Yossi, who was staying in a flat across the street. They spent a week on Zizi al-Bakri himself before branching off into his associates and the other members of his entourage and inner circle. Special attention was paid to Azir bin Talal, the omnipresent chief of AAB security. Bin Talal was an intelligence service unto himself, with a staff of security agents inside AAB and a network of paid informants scattered around the world that fed him reports about potential threats to AAB properties or Zizi himself.
If Zizi likes the merchandise, it's Bin Talal who does the due diligence, explained Lavon. No one gets near the chief without first passing muster with Bin Talal. If anyone steps out of line, it's Bin Talal who lowers the boom.
Yossi's research uncovered no fewer than a half dozen former al-Bakri associates who had died under mysterious circumstances, a fact that was withheld from Sarah at Gabriel's request. In the days that followed, the Surrey safe house was visited by what were known in the office as experts with handles. The first was a woman from Hebrew University who spent 2 nights lecturing Sarah on Saudi social customs. Next came a psychiatrist who spent 2 more nights counseling her on ways to combat fear and anxiety while working undercover. A specialist in communications gave her a primer on elementary forms of secret writing. A martial arts trainer taught her the basics of Israeli-style hand-to-hand combat. Gabriel chose Lavon, the greatest watcher in the history of the office, to give her a crash course in the art of human and electronic surveillance.
"You'll be entering a hostile camp," he told her in summation. "Assume they're watching your every move and listening to your every word. If you do that, nothing can go wrong."
Gabriel, for the most part, remained a spectator to her training. He greeted her when she arrived at the house each evening, joined the team for dinner, then saw her off again at midnight when she set out for London with Yossi. As the days wore on, they began to detect a restlessness in him. Lavon, who had worked with him more than the others, diagnosed Gabriel's mood as impatience.
"He wants to put her into play," Lavon said, "but he knows she's not ready."
He began spending extended periods before the canvas, painstakingly repairing the damage done to Marguerite. The intensity of the work only increased his restiveness. Lavon advised him to take breaks now and again, and Gabriel reluctantly agreed. He found a pair of Wellington boots in the mudroom and ventured out on solitary marches over the footpaths surrounding the village. He dug out a rod and reel from the storage room in the cellar and used it to haul an enormous brown trout from the stock pond. In the barn, concealed beneath a tarpaulin, he found an ancient MG motor car that looked as though it hadn't been driven in 20 years. 3 days later, the others heard a sputtering sound emanating from the barn, followed by an explosion that reverberated over the countryside. Yakov came running down from the house, fearful Gabriel had blown himself to bits, but instead found him standing over the open hood of the MG, covered in engine grease up to his elbows, and smiling for the first time since they'd come to Surrey.
"It works!" he shouted over the thunderous rattle of the motor. "The damned thing still runs!"
That evening he joined in Sarah's training session for the first time. Lavon and Yakov were not surprised, for the topic of discussion was none other than Abed bin Shafiq, the man who had become Gabriel's personal bete noire. He chose Dina, with her pleasant voice and patina of early widowhood, to deliver the briefings. On the first night, she lectured on Group 205, Bin Shafiq's secret unit within the GID, and showed how the combination of Wahhabi ideology and Saudi money had wreaked havoc across the Middle East and South Asia. On the second night, she recounted Bin Shafiq's journey from loyal servant of the Saudi state to mastermind of the Brotherhood of Allah. Then she described in detail the operation against the Vatican, though she made no mention of the fact that Gabriel had been present at the scene of the crime. Gabriel realized that much of the information was superfluous, but he wanted Sarah to have no doubt in her mind that Ahmed Bin Shafiq had earned the fate that awaited him. On the final night, they showed her a series of computer-generated photo illustrations of how Bin Shafiq might look now. Bin Shafiq with a beard. Bin Shafiq with a balding pate. Bin Shafiq with a gray wig. With a black wig. With curly hair. With no hair at all. With his sharp Bedouin features softened by a plastic surgeon. But it was the wounded arm that would be her most valuable clue to his identity, Gabriel told her. The scar on the inside of his forearm he would never show. The slightly withered hand that he would never offer and keep safely tucked away, hidden from infidel eyes. We know he's concealed somewhere within Zizi's empire, Gabriel said. He might come as an investment banker or a portfolio manager. He might come as a real estate developer or a pharmaceutical executive. He might come in a month. He might come in a year. He might never come. But if he does come, you can be certain he'll be well-mannered and worldly and seem like anything but a professional terrorist. Don't look for a terrorist or someone who acts like a terrorist. Just look for a man. He gathered up the photo illustrations. We want to know about everyone who moves in and out of Zizi's orbit. We want you to gather as many names as you can, but this is the man we're looking for. Gabriel placed a photograph on the table in front of her. This is the man we want. Another photograph. This is the man we're after. Another. He's the reason we're all here instead of being home with our families and our children. Another. He's the reason we asked you to give up your life and join us. Another. If you see him, you're to get us the name he's using and the company he's working for. Get the country of his passport if you can. Another photograph. If you're not sure it's him, it doesn't matter. Tell us. If it doesn't turn out to be him, it doesn't matter. Tell us. Nothing happens based on your word alone. No one gets hurt because of you, Sarah. You're only the messenger. And if I give you a name, she asked, what happens then? Gabriel looked at his watch. I think it's time Sarah and I had a word in private. Would you all excuse us? He led her upstairs to his studio and switched on the halogen lamps. Marguerite Gachet glowed seductively under the intense white light. Sarah sat down in an ancient wing chair. Gabriel slipped on his magnifying visor and prepared his palette. How much longer? She asked. It was the same question Shamron had posed to him that windswept afternoon in October when he had come to Narkis Street to haul Gabriel out of exile. A year, he should have said to Shamron that day. And then he wouldn't be here in a safe house in Surrey, about to send a beautiful American girl into the heart of Jihad Incorporated. I've removed the surface dirt and pressed the creases back into place with a warm, damp spatula, Gabriel said. Now I have to finish the inpainting and apply a light coat of varnish, just enough to bring out the warmth of Vincent's original colors. I wasn't talking about the painting. He looked up from his palette. I suppose that depends entirely on you. I'm ready when you are, she said. Not quite. What happens if Zizi doesn't bite? What happens if he doesn't like the painting, or me? No serious collector with money like Zizi is going to turn down a newly discovered Van Gogh. And as for you, you won't have much choice in the matter. We're going to make you irresistible. How? There are some things it's better you not know. Like what happens to Ahmed Bin Shafiq if I see him? He added pigment to a puddle of medium and mixed it with a brush. You know what happens to Ahmed Bin Shafiq. I made that very clear to you in Washington the night we met. Tell me everything, she said. I need to know. Gabriel lowered his visor and lifted his brush to the canvas. When he spoke again, he spoke not to Sarah, but to Marguerite.
We'll watch him. We'll listen to him if we can. We'll take his photograph and get his voice on tape and send it to our experts for analysis.
And if your experts determine it's him?
At the time and place of our choosing, we'll put him down.
Put him down?
Assassinate him. Kill him. Liquidate him. You choose the word that makes you most comfortable, Sarah. I've never found one.
How many times have you done this?
He put his face close to the painting and murmured, Many times, Sarah.
How many have you killed? 10? 20? Has it solved the problem of terrorism? Or has it just made things worse? If you find Ahmed bin Shafiq and kill him, what will it accomplish? Will it end, or will another man step forward and take his place?
Eventually, another murderer will take his place. In the meantime, lives will be saved, and justice will be done.
Is it really justice? Can justice really be done with a silenced pistol or a booby-trapped car? He lifted the visor and turned around, his green eyes flashing in the glare of the lamps.
Are you enjoying this little debate about the moral relevancy of counterterrorism? Is it making you feel better? You can rest assured Ahmed bin Shafiq never wastes time wrestling with these questions of morality. You can be certain that if he ever manages to acquire a nuclear device, the only debate he'll have is whether to use it against New York or Tel Aviv.
Is it justice, Gabriel, or only vengeance?
Again he saw himself and Shamron. This time the setting was not Gabriel's flat in Narkis Street, but a warm afternoon in September 1972, the day Shamron first came for him. Gabriel had posed the same question.
It's not too late, Sarah. You can get out if you want. We can find someone else to take your place.
There is no one else like me. Besides, I don't want out.
Then what do you want?
Permission to sleep at night.
Sleep, Sarah. Sleep very well.
And you?
I have a painting to finish.
He turned around and lowered his visor again. Sarah was not done with him.
Was it true? She asked. All the things written about you in the newspapers after the Gare de Lyon attack?
Most of it.
You killed the Palestinians from Black September who carried out the Munich massacre?
Some of them.
Would you do it again, knowing everything you know now?
He hesitated a moment.
Yes, Sarah, I would do it again. And I'll tell you why. It wasn't about vengeance. Black September was the most lethal terror group the world had ever seen, and it needed to be put out of business.
But look at what it cost you. You lost your family.
Everyone who engages in this fight loses something. Take your country, for example. You were innocent, a shining beacon of freedom and decency. Now you have blood on your hands and men in secret prisons. We don't do this sort of work because we enjoy it. We do it because we have to. We do it because we have no choice. You think I have a choice? You think Dina Sarid has a choice? We don't. And neither do you.
He looked at her for a moment.
Unless you'd like me to find someone else to go in your place.
There is no one else like me, she repeated. When will I be ready?
Gabriel turned and lifted his brush to the painting. Soon, he thought. 1 or 2 days more of inpainting, then a coat of varnish. Then she would be ready. All that remained was her field training. Lavon and Uzi Navot put her through her paces. For 3 days and nights they took her into the streets of London and drilled her on the basic tenets of tradecraft. They taught her how to make a clandestine meeting and how to determine if a site was compromised. They taught her how to spot physical surveillance and simple techniques for shaking it. They taught her how to make a dead drop and how to hand material to a live courier. They taught her how to dial the office emergency lines on ordinary pay telephones, and how to signal them with her body if she were blown and required extraction. Lavon would later describe her as the finest natural amateur field agent he had ever trained. He could have completed the course in 2 days, but Gabriel, if only for his own peace of mind, insisted on a third. When Lavon finally returned to Surrey that afternoon, he found Gabriel standing morosely at the edge of the stock pond, with a rod in one hand and his eyes trained on the surface of the water as though willing a fish to rise.
She's ready, Lavon said. The question is, are you?
Gabriel slowly reeled in his line and followed Lavon back to the house. Later that same evening, the lights went dark in the melancholy little travel agency in Mason's Yard. Miss Archer, clutching a batch of old files, paused for a moment on the landing and peered through the sparkling glass entrance of Isherwood Fine Arts. Seated behind the receptionist desk was Elena, Mr. Isherwood's scandalously pretty Italian secretary. She glanced up from her computer screen and blew Miss Archer an elaborate farewell kiss, then looked down again and resumed her work. Miss Archer smiled sadly and headed down the stairway. There were no tears in her eyes. She'd done her crying in private, the way she did most things. Nor was there hesitation in her step. For 27 years she'd been coming to this office 5 mornings a week, Saturdays, too, if there was housekeeping to be done. She was looking forward to retirement, even if it had come a bit earlier than expected. Maybe she'd take a long holiday. Or maybe she'd take a cottage in the countryside. She'd had her eye on a little place in the Chilterns for some time. She was certain of only one thing. She wasn't sorry to be leaving. Mason's Yard would never be the same again, not with the flashy Miss Bancroft in residence. It wasn't that Miss Archer had anything against Americans personally. She just wasn't terribly interested in living next door to one. As she neared the bottom of the stairs, a buzzer groaned, and the automatic locks on the outer door snapped open. "Thank you, Elena," she thought as she stepped outside into the chill evening air. "Can't get off your shapely little backside to give a proper goodbye. Now you're practically shoving me out the door." She was tempted to violate Mr. Isherwood's long-standing edict about waiting for the door to lock again, but professional to the end, she stayed 10 more seconds until the dull thump of the deadbolts sent her shuffling slowly toward the passageway. She did not know that her departure was being monitored by a 3-man Neviot team waiting in a van parked on the opposite side of Duke Street. The team remained in their van for another hour, just to make certain she hadn't forgotten anything. Then, shortly before 8, they slipped through the passageway and made their way slowly across the bricks of the old yard toward the gallery. To Julian Isherwood, who watched their unhurried approach from the window of his office, they seemed like grave diggers with a long night ahead. Chapter 19, London. The operation began in earnest late the following morning when Julian Isherwood, London art dealer of some repute, placed a discreet telephone call to the Knightsbridge residence of Andrew Malone, exclusive art advisor to Zizi Albakri. It was answered by a drowsy woman who informed Isherwood that Malone was out of the country. "A fugitive from justice?" he asked, trying to make light of an awkward situation.
"Try his mobile,"
the woman said before slamming down the phone. Fortunately, Isherwood had the number. He immediately dialed it and, as instructed, left a brief message. The better part of the day elapsed before Malone bothered to call him back.
"I'm in Rome," he said sotto voce. "Something big, very big."
"Hardly surprising, Andrew. You only do big."
Malone batted away Isherwood's attempt at flattery.
"I'm afraid I only have a moment," he said. "What can I do for you, Julie?"
"I think I might have something for you. Something for your client, actually."
"My client doesn't do the old masters."
"The something I have for your client isn't old master, it's impressionist. And not just any impressionist, if you're getting my drift. It's special, Andrew. It's the sort of thing that only a handful of collectors in the world can even dream about owning. And your man happens to be one of them. I'm offering you a first look, Andrew. An exclusive first look. Any interest, or shall I take my business elsewhere?"
"Do tell more, Julie."
"Sorry, darling, but it's not the sort of thing one discusses over the telephone. How about lunch tomorrow? I'm buying."
"I'm going to Tokyo tomorrow. There's a collector there who has a Monet my man wants."
"How about the day after tomorrow, then?"
"That's my jet lag day. Let's make it Thursday, shall we?"
You won't regret this, Andrew.
Regrets are what sustain us. Ciao, Julie.
Isherwood hung up the telephone and looked at the heavy-shouldered man with strawberry-blonde hair seated on the opposite side of the desk.
Nicely done, said Uzi Navot. But next time, let Zizi buy lunch.
It came as no surprise to Gabriel that Andrew Malone was in Rome, because he had been under electronic and physical surveillance for nearly a week. He had gone to the Eternal City to acquire a certain Degas sculpture that Zizi had had his eye on for quite some time, but left empty-handed on Monday night, and proceeded to Tokyo. The anonymous collector whom Malone hoped to relieve of a Monet was none other than the famed industrialist Morita Watanabe. Based on the defeatist expression on Malone's face as he was leaving Watanabe's apartment, Gabriel concluded the negotiations had not gone well. That evening, Malone phoned Isherwood to say he was staying in Tokyo a day longer than expected.
I'm afraid we're going to have to postpone our little get-together, he said. Can we do it next week?
Gabriel, who was anxious to get underway, instructed Isherwood to hold fast, and the meeting was pushed back just one day, from the Thursday to the Friday, though Isherwood did agree to make it a late lunch so that Malone could catch a few hours of sleep in his own bed. Malone did, in fact, remain in Tokyo for an additional day, but the Tokyo station detected no further contact between him and Watanabe or any of Watanabe's agents. He returned to London late Thursday evening, looking, according to Ellie Lavon, like a cadaver in a Savile Row suit. At 3:30 the next afternoon, the cadaver crept through the doorway of Green's restaurant in Duke Street and made his way to the quiet corner table where Isherwood was already waiting. Isherwood poured him a very large glass of white burgundy.
All right, Julie, said Malone. Let's cut the bullshit, shall we? What have you got up your sleeve, and who the fuck put it there?
Chiara was waiting at the top of the landing 90 minutes later when Isherwood, fortified by 2 bottles of excellent white burgundy at Gabriel's expense, came teetering up the newly carpeted stairs. She directed him to the left, into the former premises of Archer Travel, where he was met by one of Gabriel's Neviot listeners. He removed his coat and unbuttoned his shirt, revealing the small digital recording device secured to his chest by an elastic cummerbund.
I don't usually do this sort of thing on the first date, he said.
The Neviot man removed the recorder and smiled.
How was the lobster?
Bit chewy, but otherwise fine.
You did well, Mr. Isherwood, very well.
It's my last deal, I suspect. Now let's hope I don't go out with a bang.
The recording could have been sent by secure transmission, but Gabriel, like Adrian Carter, was still old-fashioned about some things, and he insisted that it be downloaded onto a disc and hand-carried to the Surrey safe house. As a result, it was after 8 by the time it finally arrived. He loaded the disc into a computer in the drawing room and clicked the play icon. Dina was sprawled on the couch with her injured leg elevated to relieve the constant pain she never mentioned to any of the others. Yakov was seated in an armchair with his chin in his hands and elbows on his knees, hunched forward as though he were awaiting word from the front. It was Ramona's night to cook. As Andrew Malone began to speak, she shouted at Gabriel from the kitchen to turn up the volume so she could hear it too.
Do you take me for a fool, Julian? It's the real thing, Andrew. I've seen it with my own eyes. Do you have a photograph? I wasn't allowed. Who's the owner? The owner wishes to remain anonymous. Yes, of course, but who the hell is it, Julian? I cannot divulge the name of the owner, period. End of discussion. She's entrusted me as her representative in this matter, and that's as far as it goes. She. So the owner is a woman. The painting has been in the same family for 3 generations. Currently, it is in the hands of a woman. That sort of family, Julian, give me a tickle. A French family, Andrew, and that's all you're getting from me. I'm afraid that's not going to work, Julian. You have to give me something I can hang my hat on. I can't go to Zizi empty-handed. Zizi gets annoyed when that happens. If you want Zizi in the game, you'll have to play by Zizi's rules. I won't be bullied, Andrew. I came to you as a favor. Frankly, I don't give a shit about Zizi's rules. Frankly, I don't need Zizi at all. If I put the word on the street that I'm sitting on an undiscovered Van Gogh, every major collector and museum in the world will be beating down my door and throwing money at me. Do please try to keep that in mind. Forgive me, Julie, it's been a long week. Let's start over, shall we? Yes, let's. May I pose a few harmless questions? Depends on how harmless. Let's start with an easy one. Where's the painting now? France or England? It's here in London. In your gallery? Not yet. What sort of painting are we talking about? Landscape? Still life? Portrait? Portrait. Self? No. Male or female? Female. Dreamy. Early or late? Very late. Saint-Remy or Vert? The latter, Andrew. It was painted during the final days of his life in Auvers. The only woman that captured Vincent's fancy in Auvers was Marguerite Gachet. You're not sitting on an undiscovered portrait of Marguerite Gachet, are you, Julian? Maybe we should have a glance at the menu. Fuck the menu, Julian. Answer the question. Are you sitting on an undiscovered portrait of Marguerite? I've gone as far as I can in terms of the content, Andrew. And that's final. If you want to know what it is, you'll have to take a look at it for yourself. You're offering me a look. I'm offering your man a look, not you. Easier said than done. Running the world keeps my man busy. I'm prepared to offer you and Zizi exclusivity for 72 hours. After that, I'll have to open it up to other collectors. Bad form, Julian. My man doesn't like ultimatums. It's not an ultimatum, it's just business. He understands that. What kind of price tag are we talking about? 85 million. 85 million. Then you do indeed need Zizi. You see, money is a bit tight at the moment, isn't it? Can't remember the last time someone's laid down 85 million for something, can you, Julie? This painting is worth every penny. If it is what you say it is, and if it's in perfect condition, I'll get you your 85 million in very short order. You see, my man has been looking for something splashy like this for a very long time, but then you knew that, didn't you, Julie? That's why you brought it to me first. You knew we could get the deal done in an afternoon. No auctions, no press, no nagging questions about your quiet little French woman who wants to remain anonymous. I'm the goose that lays the golden egg, as far as you're concerned, and you're going to have to give the goose his due. What on earth are you talking about, Andrew? You know precisely what I'm talking about. Maybe I'm a bit slow today. Mind spelling it out? I'm talking about money, Julian. I'm talking about a very small slice of a very large pie. You want a cut? A piece of the action? As the Americans like to say. Let's leave the Americans out of this, shall we? My man's not terribly fond of the Americans at the moment. What sort of slice are we talking about, Andrew? Let's say, just for argument's sake, that your commission on the sale is 10%. That means you'll clear $8.5 million for an afternoon's work. I'm asking for 10% of your 10%. Actually, I'm not asking, I'm demanding it. And you'll pay it because that's the way the game is played. To the best of my faded recollection, you are Zizi Al-Bakri's exclusive art consultant. Zizi pays you an outrageous salary. You practically live on Zizi's expense account, and you spend most of your free time relaxing at Zizi's properties. He does this so that the advice you bring him remains untainted by other dealings on your part, but you've been playing both sides of the street, haven't you, Andrew? How long has it been going on? How much have you been skimming? How much of ZZ's money have you got salted away? It's not ZZ's money, it's my money, and what ZZ doesn't know won't hurt him. And if he finds out, he'll drop you in the empty quarter and let the vultures pick over your bones. Precisely, love, which is why you're never going to mention a word of this to ZZ. I'm offering you $7.5 million for an afternoon's work. Not bad, Julie, take the deal. Let's get rich together, shall we? All right, Andrew. You'll get your 10%. But I want ZZ Albakri in my gallery in all his glory in 72 hours, or the deal's off.
Gabriel stopped the recording, reset it, and played the final bit again.
But you've been playing both sides of the street, haven't you, Andrew? How long has it been going on? How much have you been skimming? How much of ZZ's money have you got salted away? It's not ZZ's money, it's my money, and what ZZ doesn't know won't hurt him. And if he finds out, he'll drop you in the empty quarter and let the vultures pick over your bones. Precisely, love, which is why you're never going to mention a word of this to ZZ.
Gabriel closed the file and removed the disk from the computer.
Mr. Malone has been a very bad boy, said Yakov. Yes, he has, said Gabriel, but then Gabriel had known that for some time.
Don't you think that someone should tell ZZ about it? Asked Dina. It's only right.
Yes, said Gabriel, slipping the disk into his pocket. Someone should, but not yet.
It was among the longest 72 hours any of them had ever endured. There were false starts and false promises, commitments made and broken within the span of an afternoon. Malone played the role of the intimidator 1 minute and the supplicant the next.
ZZ's in a bit of a bind,
he said late Saturday.
ZZ's in the middle of a major deal. ZZ's doing Delhi today and Singapore tomorrow. He can't possibly make time for London until midweek.
Isherwood held firm. ZZ's exclusive window closed Monday at 5 p.m., he said. After that, he'd find himself in a scrum, fighting it out with all comers. Late on the Sunday evening, Malone phoned with the disappointing news that ZZ was taking a pass. Gabriel was not the least bit concerned, because that very afternoon, the Neviot team stationed in Archer Travel had seen a well-dressed Arab in his mid-30s making an obvious reconnaissance run of Mason's Yard. Lavon, after viewing the surveillance photographs, identified the man as Jafar Sharuki, a former Saudi National Guardsman who served as one of ZZ's advance security men.
He's coming, Lavon said. ZZ always likes to play hard to get.
The call they were all expecting came at precisely 10:22 the following morning. It was Andrew Malone, and even though they could not see him, they knew the cadaver was all smiles. ZZ was on his way to London, he said. ZZ would be at Isherwood's gallery at 4:30.
ZZ has a few rules, Malone said before ringing off. No alcohol or cigarettes, and make sure those two girls of yours are properly dressed. ZZ likes pretty girls, but he likes them modestly attired. He's a religious man, our ZZ. He's easily offended.
Chapter 20, London. Marguerite Gachet was the first to arrive. She came in the back of an unmarked van, driven by a Bodell from London Station, and was secreted into the premises of Isherwood Fine Arts through the secure loading bay. The delivery was monitored by two men from Wazir bin Talal's security unit, who were seated in a parked car in Duke Street, and by Jafar Sharuki, the advance man, who was picking at a plate of fish and chips in the pub next door to Isherwood's gallery. Confirmation of the painting's safe transfer arrived at the Surrey Safe House at 3:18 p.m. in the form of a secure email from the Neviot team. It was taken in by Dina, then read aloud to Gabriel, who was at that moment slowly pacing the threadbare carpet in the drawing room. He paused for a moment and tipped his head, as though listening to distant music, then resumed his restless journey. He felt as helpless as a playwright on opening night. He had created the characters, given them their lines, and could see them now on a stage of his making. He could see Isherwood in his chalk-striped suit and lucky red tie, craving a drink and nibbling on the nail of his left forefinger to relieve the tension. And Kiara, seated behind her glossy new receptionist desk, with her hair drawn sensibly back and her long legs crossed primly at the ankle. And Sarah, in the black Chanel suit she'd bought at Harrod's 2 weeks earlier, propped serenely on the divan in the upstairs exhibition room, with her eyes on Marguerite Gachet and her thoughts on the monster who would be coming up the lift in 2 hours' time. If he could have rewritten anyone's role, it would have been Sarah's. It was too late for that now. The curtain was about to rise. And so all the playwright could do now was pace the drawing room of his safe house and wait for the updates. At 3:04, Mr. Baker's 747 was seen on low approach to Heathrow Airport, Mr. Baker being their code name for Zizi Albakri. At 3:32 came word that Mr. Baker and his entourage had cleared VIP customs. At 3:45 they were seen boarding their limousines, and at 3:52 those same limousines were seen trying to set a land speed record on the A4. At 4:09, Mr. Baker's artistic advisor, whom they codenamed Marlowe, telephoned Isherwood from the motorcade to say they were running a few minutes behind schedule. That turned out not to be the case, however, because at 4:27 the same motorcade was spotted turning into Duke Street from Piccadilly. There then followed the first stumble of the afternoon. Thankfully, it was Zizi's and not theirs. It came as the first limousine was attempting to negotiate the narrow passageway from Duke Street into Mason's Yard. A moment into the exercise, the driver determined that the cars were too large to fit through the breach. Cherokee, the advance man, had neglected to take a proper measurement. And so the final message that Gabriel received from the Neviot team stated that Mr. Baker, chairman and CEO of Jihad Inc., was getting out of his car and walking to the gallery. But Sarah was not waiting in the upstairs exhibition room. She was at that moment one floor below, in the office she shared with Julian, gazing out at the rather farcical scene taking place in the passageway. It was her first act of rebellion. Gabriel had wanted her to remain upstairs, hidden from view until the final moment, so that she could be unveiled along with Marguerite. She would obey his order eventually, but not until she saw Zizi once with her own eyes. She had studied his face in Yossi's magazine clippings and had memorized the sound of his voice in the videos. But clippings and videos were no substitute for a glimpse of the real thing. And so she stood there, in blatant contravention of Gabriel's instructions, and watched as Zizi and his entourage came filing through the passage into the darkened quadrangle. Rafik Akamal, chief of Zizi's personal security detail, came first. He was bigger than he had appeared in the photographs, but moved with the agility of a man half his size. He had no overcoat, because an overcoat would interfere with his draw. He had no conscience, either, Ellie Lavon had told her. He made one quick survey of the yard, like a scout looking for signs of the enemy, then turned and, with an old-fashioned hand signal, beckoned the others forward. Next came two very pretty girls with long black hair and long coats, looking peeved for having to walk the 100 feet from the stranded cars to the gallery. The one on the right was Nadia Albakri, Zizi's spoiled daughter. The one on the left was Rahima Hamza, daughter of Daoud Hamza, the Stanford-educated Lebanese reputed to be the true financial genius behind AAB Holdings. Hamza himself was trailing a few paces behind the girls with a mobile phone pressed to his ear. After Hamza came Herr Manfred Verli, the Swiss banker who handled Zizi's money. Next to Verli was a child with no apparent owner, and behind the child two more beautiful women, one blonde, the other with short hair the color of sandstone. When the child bolted suddenly across the yard in the wrong direction, he was snared in a panther-like movement by Jean-Michel, the French kickboxer who now served as Zizi's personal trainer and auxiliary bodyguard. Abdul Halil and Abdul Hakim, American-trained lawyers, came next. Yossi had broken up one of the briefings by contemptuously pointing out that Zizi had chosen lawyers whose names meant Servant of the Great and Servant of the Wise One. After the lawyers came Mansour, chief of Zizi's travel department, then Hassan, chief of communications, then Andrew Malone, Zizi's soon-to-be-former exclusive art consultant. And finally, sandwiched between Wazir bin Talal and Jafar Sharuki was Zizi himself. Sarah turned away from the window. Under Kiara's watchful gaze, she entered the tiny lift and pressed the button for the top floor. A moment later, she was deposited into the upper exhibition room. In the center of the room, propped on a stately easel and veiled like a Muslim woman, was the Van Gogh. From below, she could hear Rafik, the bodyguard, tramping heavily up the stairs.
"You're not to think of him as a terrorist," Gabriel had said. "You're not to wonder whether any of his money ended up in the pocket of Marwan al-Shehi or any of the other terrorists who murdered Ben. You're to think of him as an extraordinarily wealthy and important man. Don't flirt with him. Don't try to seduce him. Think of it as a job interview. You're not going to bed with him. You're going to work for him. Whatever you do, don't try to give Zizi any advice. You'll ruin the sale. Both of them."
She turned and examined her appearance in the reflection of the elevator door. She was vaguely out of focus, which she found fitting. She was still Sarah Bancroft, just a different version, a reworking of the same painting. She smoothed the front of her Chanel suit. Not for Zizi, she told herself, but for Gabriel. And from below she heard the voice of the monster for the first time.
"Good evening, Mr. Isherwood," said the chairman and CEO of Jihad Incorporated. "I'm Abdul Aziz al-Bakri. Andrew tells me you have a picture for me."
The first elevator dispensed only security men. Rafik plunged into the room and groped her unabashedly with his eyes, while Sharuki peered beneath the divan for hidden weapons, and Jean-Michel, the kickboxer, roamed the perimeter on the balls of his feet like a lethal ballet dancer. The next elevator brought Malone and Isherwood, who were wedged happily between Nadia and Rahima. Zizi came on the third, with only the trusted bin Talal for company. His dark handmade suit hung gracefully over what was an otherwise paunchy physique. His beard was carefully trimmed, as was his deeply receded head of graying hair. His eyes were alert and active. They settled immediately on the one person in the room whose name he did not know.
"Don't attempt to introduce yourself, Sarah. Don't look him directly in the eye. If there's a move to be made, let it be Zizi who makes it."
She looked down at her shoes. The elevator doors opened again, this time disgorging Abdul and Abdul, servants of the Great Wise One, and Herr Verli, the Swiss money man. Sarah watched them enter, then cast a glance at Zizi, who was still staring at her.
"Forgive me, Mr. al-Bakri," Isherwood said. "My manners are atrocious today. This is Sarah Bancroft, our assistant director. It's because of Sarah we're all here tonight."
"Don't try to shake his hand. If he offers his, take it briefly and let go."
She stood very straight, with her hands behind her back and her eyes downward at a slight angle. Zizi's eyes were roving over her. There was nothing sexual in his gaze. He was simply taking the measure of her. Finally, he stepped forward and extended his hand.
"It's a pleasure to meet you."
She took it and heard herself say, "The pleasure is mine, Mr. al-Bakri. It's an honor to meet you, sir."
This is the end of disc number 5. Please insert disc number 6.